The most commented story on Hacker News today, 397 comments and a score of 544, is a blog post titled, "It's not about physical versus digital games. It's about ownership." And I want to give this piece the attention it deserves because it's not really a gaming story. It's a property rights story dressed in gaming clothes.
The author's core argument is that the physical versus digital debate has been framed incorrectly for years. People talk about whether they prefer a disc or a download, when the real question is whether you actually own what you purchased or whether you've licensed temporary access to it at someone else's discretion. And the HN comment thread is full of people who've experienced this firsthand: games pulled from stores, servers shut down, licenses revoked after platform policy changes.
What makes this argument resonate particularly strongly right now is the consolidation happening across gaming platforms. We've seen multiple instances in the past 2 years where a company was acquired, the new parent entity decided certain titles weren't worth maintaining, and players who paid full price for those games simply lost access. There's no consumer protection framework in most jurisdictions that meaningfully addresses digital goods the way lemon laws address physical products.
And this connects to a broader economic pattern I find interesting. When you move from selling a product to licensing access to a product, you fundamentally shift where the risk sits. With physical goods, once I buy the disc, the company's obligation to me is essentially complete. With digital licensing, they retain ongoing obligations: server costs, maintenance, policy enforcement, but they've also retained the right to revoke my access whenever those obligations become inconvenient. The consumer got the worst of both worlds, paid full price upfront, received no durable asset.
The HN comments are splitting pretty clearly between people who think this is a systemic regulatory failure and people who argue that market forces should handle it, that consumers will eventually migrate to platforms that offer better ownership terms. What's notable is how few people are actually defending the current model. Even the market forces advocates tend to agree the status quo is unfair. They just disagree about the remedy.
There's a case to be made that this is where antitrust thinking needs to evolve, actually. And since we're on the subject, this feels like a natural moment to explain something that comes up constantly in tech conversations, but often gets misunderstood: how antitrust law actually works in the United States. Because a lot of people hear monopoly and think it just means a big company, but the legal standard is considerably more specific.
Walk us through it, Marcus.
So the foundational law in the U.S. is the Sherman Antitrust Act, passed in 1890. Section 1 prohibits contracts or conspiracies that unreasonably restrain trade. That's where price-fixing agreements between competitors get prosecuted. Section 2 is what most tech cases hinge on, and it prohibits monopolization or attempts to monopolize a market. The key word there is monopolization, as a verb, not just possessing market power. You can be enormous and dominant and not violate Section 2 as long as you got there through legitimate competition, better products, lower prices, genuine innovation. The law only kicks in when you use exclusionary conduct to maintain or extend that dominance. Courts use a rough threshold of around 70% market share as a starting point for monopoly power analysis. But market share alone isn't enough. Think of it this way: if one bakery in a small town makes the best bread and everyone buys from them, that's not illegal. It's only illegal if they're paying the flour supplier to refuse to sell to competitors. That conduct element is what the Department of Justice had to prove in the Google search case. And it's what makes digital platform cases so complex, because the exclusionary conduct is often baked into defaults and contracts rather than visible market behavior.
And this is directly relevant to digital ownership, because if a platform like Steam or a console manufacturer reaches the point where they're using their market position to prevent developers from offering DRM-free alternatives, not just competing, but actively blocking alternatives, that's where antitrust scrutiny could theoretically attach. The challenge is proving that conduct nexus.
Right. And the European Digital Markets Act is actually further along on this than U.S. law, which is why we're seeing more movement on interoperability and consumer rights for digital goods in the EU than domestically.
Shifting to another story about how things get built and then fade, Daniel Stanica's piece, The Great Blogging Collapse, tracked what happened to 100 once successful blogs, and the findings scored 190 points with 144 comments. The short version is that the vast majority of those blogs are either dead, posting sporadically, or have pivoted to newsletter formats. And the reasons are pretty consistent. SEO algorithm changes wiped out organic traffic, social media discovery replaced blog discovery, and the economics of maintaining a blog never scaled the way newsletter subscriptions can.
What struck me about the HN discussion is how many people pointed to the 2023 to 2024 period as the inflection. That's when Google's helpful content updates and the rise of AI-generated SEO spam combined to make organic search essentially hostile to small independent publishers. If you weren't already a recognized authority or you didn't have a newsletter list, your traffic simply collapsed.
And there's something quietly sad about that from an information ecosystem perspective. Blogs were how a lot of technical knowledge got shared in the early internet. People writing detailed tutorials, debugging write-ups, personal experiments. A lot of that knowledge now either lives behind newsletter paywalls or doesn't get written at all because the incentive structure is broken.
The HN comments had a few counterexamples. Writers who've actually grown audiences in this environment by going narrow and deep rather than broad, and by treating newsletters as the primary medium with the blog as archive. But the consensus seemed to be that the era of a blog as a standalone discovery vehicle is over unless you're already embedded in a community like HN.